All right, so today is Thursday, February 27th. We're going to start back with a review of page 58. Okay. So I'm just going to start you back from the beginning with this whole conversation. What we talked about on Thursday or Tuesday was bulk fluid transport at a capillary. And what we mean by that is we're looking for a way to fluids to get pushed out into your interstitial space and then return back into your capillary. All of this is possible because of the construction of your capillary. So what is the typical layer that you find in a capillary? Tunica externa, media, intima? Yeah, good, intima, that inside lining. And it's really only one cell layer thick. It's simple squamous tissue. These capillaries also have to be fenestrated in order for us to do this bulk fluid transport. Fenestrated means they have what? Yeah, they got holes or pores. Things can be flushed out of them and then be pulled back in. Hey, if these were closed capillaries, you could not get things to move between the capillary and these cells and tissues. Okay, so what we're looking at here is a capillary. Here's the arterial end feeding into the capillary. Blood flows through. Of course, it's typically a network or a capillary bed. It exits by way of that venule at the other end. We have fluids inside the capillary. What are those fluids called? Blood plasma. Yeah, blood plasma inside. And then, of course, we've got fluids outside. They're housed either in interstitial spaces or they're housed inside cells, okay? So all of this is fluid that can ultimately be exchanged from one place to another. We will actually come back and repeat this entire topic in a later chapter and then talk about how do you get these fluids to shift locations. We talked about two main pressures. We talked about a hydrostatic pressure and an osmotic pressure, okay? And which of these pressures is the one created by the blood plasma's fluids? Hydrostatic, good. So does that fluid have a force of push or a pull force?
Push.
Okay. I'm just going to put a note that this is our pushing pressure. All right. That blood osmotic pressure is one that's going to create a pull or an attraction. And, of course, solutes, proteins, things like that are going to attract fluids and pull them back into the capillary. So it is about 26 millimeters mercury. Like I mentioned in class on Tuesday, don't memorize the numbers here, but rather look at the concept of the fact that we're pushing with force from fluids and we're pulling by the force created from those proteins and those solutes. Okay, so when you look at these numbers, you say, well, I'm pushing out of the capillary with a force of 35 millimeters mercury. That's blood pressure. Blood hydrostatic pressure is blood pressure. We're only able to pull back in with the force created by those salts and proteins. That pressure is only 26. So the higher of the two numbers here is the one that wins the battle. So because hydrostatic is higher, what happens to fluids coming into the arterial end of your capillary? So your hydrostatic's the higher number. It's the pushing pressure. What happens to fluids that come into this arterial end of your capillary? They get pushed out. Okay, so because hydrostatic and push is your higher of the two, that helps us accomplish a push out into that interstitial space. Do you remember the name of that process where we were pushing out those fluids?
Filtration.
Good. We also calculated a number on Tuesday. It's called NFP, or net filtration pressure for short. And what this says is, if we're pushing out with 35 millimeters mercury, and salts and proteins are pulling fluids back into your capillary only with 26 millimeters, we also have to take into account the small pressures out here in the interstitial space. I mentioned it was fuzzy math. It's, you know, we're including all of the push and pulls here, and it comes up with an overall push of about how many millimeters mercury?
10.
About 10. So let me mention to you that there are tiny pressures in your interstitial space. We call them, again, hydrostatic pressures and osmotic pressures. So if I have fluids out here in the interstitial space that are pushing, are they water-based or are they protein-based?
Water.
They're water-based, right. So in fact, I will have a hydrostatic pressure of the interstitial fluid that creates a small bit of push, and that fluid is going to push wherever it can go. It may push back into the capillary, may try to push into the cells, but it's a small number. It's like 1 millimeter mercury or less, so it's a tiny bit of push there. There's also osmotic pressure out here. What creates that? What creates any osmotic? Solutes, right. So there's a tiny bit of solutes out there that are creating a pull, and so with 1 millimeter less mercury, they're creating a pull of fluids to come to that interstitial space. You know, when you're talking about the big push-pull event, it's really here in the capillary, 35 and 26. When you're talking about 1 millimeter push or 1 millimeter pull, that's nothing. That hardly plays any role at all in the overall movement of these fluids. So I neglected to talk about them on Tuesday on purpose because they really don't play a big role in our push-pull event at all. Okay, so if you think about a tire that has some holes in it, that's the worst thing ever, right? You're going somewhere, your tire's leaking, you know the air pressure is coming out of it. You know that if you keep driving on that tire, you're going to have a flat. And why is that? What happens to all the air in that tire? It's being pushed out, yeah, it leaks out. So same thing here with our capillary. If we keep pushing and pushing fluids out, our fluids all get escaped into that interstitial space. And unfortunately, if you push all your fluids out and you don't reclaim them back in, what happens to your blood pressure? It goes down, right. So we ultimately lose hydrostatic pressure. We're losing pressure because we're forcing fluids out as we travel down the length of the capillary. In fact, as you reach this venule end of the capillary, your hydrostatic pressure is going to drop somewhere into the mid-teens, okay? And so that means that we are now pretty low in terms of blood pressure. And this creates another scenario for us. Your osmotic pressure is still the same. It's gonna be about 26 millimeters. So all we have to do is compare numbers. The higher number wins the battle. So now which is your highest pressure? So what's going to happen to fluids at the venule end of your capillary? They're going to be pulled back in because this pressure is your pull pressure. So it's got the better of the two powers now, and so it helps to return the fluids back into the capillary. Why is this critical for blood pressure? If you didn't pull them back in, your blood pressure would bottom out, right?
Salt.
Yeah, it's the salt, right? So it's the salt and the proteins pulling those fluids back in. Now, the problem also arises if you let that fluid hang out in the interstitial space, that interstitial space gets really tight with a lot of excess fluid. And when you put excess fluid out there, we have a name for it. It's called edema. And we want to avoid that because that's pretty uncomfortable. In fact, if you leave cells sitting in excess fluid for too long, what ultimately happens to your cells? They swell, right? So they'll bloat up on us, and we also don't want that either. So it is really important that we reclaim those fluids back into the venule end of your capillary. On Tuesday, I mentioned that the push and pull is about 90% effective. That means that 90% of what you push out gets reclaimed back into the venule end of your capillary. Because this is not a completely efficient process, 100% efficient, we have to have a backup system to pick up those escaped fluids. And what would that backup system be? Lymphatic, yes. So the lymphatic system is kind of sitting there going, hey, I'm wide open. And so it picks up those escaped fluids and transports them back to the heart. Now, down here at this end, when we reabsorb those fluids back into the capillary, we have an overall net filtration pressure that is negative. That's because we're not pushing, that's because we're pulling. So what is our net filtration pressure at the venule end?
-8.
It's negative 8. Okay, so this is kind of just introducing the topic. Like I mentioned, we'll come back later in this course and talk about things that cause fluid shifts. We'll talk about dehydration from diarrhea, for instance, or vomiting. Or we'll talk about what influence a high salt diet has, excuse me, on the shift of fluids here. Okay, so some take home messages. First off, which pressure is your pushing fluid based pressure?
Hydrostatic.
Good, hydrostatic. And which pressure is based on plasma proteins like albumin or salts?
Osmotic.
Good, osmotic pressure. Which fluid is the one that assists with reabsorption at the venule end of your capillary?
Osmotic.
Osmotic, good. And which pressure is essentially the same as blood pressure? That's hydrostatic, good. Okay, so like I mentioned, we're going to ignore the hydrostatic and osmotic pressures in your interstitial space because for now, they're not really important for our conversation. All right, so that's kind of what we did on Tuesday. Is there anything I can hit for you here again? Anything I can repeat? Does this make fairly good sense? Okay, so just keep in mind there's a battle, and whoever's higher is going to be the winner for that battle.
The edema, it comes from, osmotic pressure, not too much fluid inside.
If you push out and you don't pull the fluids back in, yeah, then it sits in your interstitial space, and that's where the edema comes from. So if you do something that creates an imbalance between the hydrostatics and osmotics here, and it could be too much push or it could be not enough pull, anything that puts that fluid out here, yeah, you're gonna have the interstitial space swell first, and then your cells will swell second. Okay, so it looks like we are ready to move into lymphatic system. I just wanted to repeat a reminder. There is a good page of information to read through. That is page 60. We've talked about some of that stuff already. All right, so I'd like to get you onto page 62 with the lymphatic system. For starters, this is a system that we oftentimes don't really think about, but boy, you will certainly know it if this system has any blockages in it. I think of this one as a kind of a secondary system to the cardiovascular. And what I mean by that is it's serving to make sure the cardiovascular is efficient as possible. So it works in tandem with your cardiovascular system. You'll notice at the top up there, about 3 liters of fluid are escaped from your cardiovascular system every day. We've got to pull those back into the cardiovascular. Otherwise, what would happen to your blood pressure? It'd be low, right? So we got to make sure we get those fluids back. And in addition to your blood pressure being low, what would happen to your interstitial space? It'd swell, right? And the fancy name for that? Edema, good. So we'll also talk about the role that this system plays with your immune response in just a few moments. For now, let's just focus on what lymph is. And you'll notice that lymph listed there is actually a combination of some things. It is the fluid that escapes your bloodstream. So it's the escaped blood plasmas. Interstitial fluid is also found in lymph. And sometimes plasma proteins will also be found out here in the interstitial space. They too will be picked up by that lymph. We may also find lymphocytes here, and they're important for, you know, immune response, initiating and helping to destroy incoming viruses, things like that, identify them. So we've got to have a portion of the immune response involved because what you pick up by these lymphatic systems is going to travel to your heart, and then it will go all over your entire body. So we don't necessarily want an invader to hitch a ride and then now travel systemically. I want you to notice what's not in lymph. We shouldn't be finding red blood cells there. They should only be confined to travel in what vessels? Cardiovascular, not lymphatic, right? Okay, so red blood cells should only be confined to travel in your cardiovascular system. They should not escape. Besides, what's their job anyway? Yeah, transport oxygen, some CO2. So if you lose them to the interstitial space, then you've lost your transport device for carrying that oxygen. We also don't have platelets out there. You know, of course, they're meant for clotting, so they really have no business being outside your cardiovascular vessels. So in summary, the lymphatic vessels have mostly water, some plasma protein, some white blood cells, just no red blood cells, no platelets out there. So pretty much anything that can get pushed out of your capillary and into the interstitial space may ultimately be picked up by these lymphatic vessels. And if we look at the lymphatic vessels, these vessels all form a one-way system that flows back to the heart. So I actually need to fix something about my picture. You know, cardiovascular vessels are just an open loop. You know, we travel around the body, around the heart, and back, you know, of course, through the same circuit. Lymphatic vessels, however, are closed-end vessels. And that kind of repeats the fact that we're not actually circulating fluids through the lymphatic system like we do with the cardiovascular. These lymphatic vessels being closed in means that we only conduct fluids in one direction, and that's, of course, back to the heart. So you can see that blood is flowing toward the venule end of this capillary. Lymphatic fluid would also go in the same direction. It's heading the same direction that the veins travel, and that is all that fluid comes back where? Back to the heart. So interesting, you've got kind of this side gig going on here with the lymphatics. They're also picking up these fluids, flowing not too far away from those capillaries in the same direction with fluids. You'll notice under the anatomy of those lymph vessels, they are thin-walled. That makes sense, right? They want to be able to absorb those fluids as easily as possible. Some of the larger lymphatic vessels do have valves. What does that prevent from happening?
Backflow.
And then you'll also notice that they're low pressure. There is no way to pump fluids in your lymphatic system. Your lymphatics work simply by having some smooth muscle in the walls of the larger lymphatic vessels, and then simply your movements, your breathing, will help to return those fluids in the lymphatics back to the heart. So the same things that assisted with moving blood in those veins back to the heart is going to be the same assist that we have here for your lymphatic vessels. So taking a deep breath, walking and moving around, and some smooth muscle in the walls of those larger vessels. Okay, so let's talk about the lymph capillaries because they're the tiniest of our lymphatic vessels. Hey, notice there are no lymphatic arteries, right? Because we're not conducting lymph in a circulation pattern. We're not carrying lymph away from the heart. We're only picking it up and taking it back to the heart. So kind of a weirdo system here. You've got lymphatic capillaries, lymphatic venules, lymphatic veins, but no arteries, no arterioles. That's not the point of this system. So this particular system has what they call mini valves. You'll notice that listed there under those lymphatic capillaries. These lymph capillaries I drew as a dotted line. And in reality, if we were to enlarge how this looks, well, that thing doesn't want to work. Let's try another. There's these little doorways that are open, and these are called mini valves. These doors stand open into the interstitial fluid that surrounds on either side. And this is our lymph capillary right here. And these little doors that are standing open are called mini valves. So if you go to any shopping center, whether it's the shopping mall here in Florence, whether it's maybe a boardwalk at a beach somewhere, if those shopping centers and those stores prop open their doorways, you are more likely to go inside and shop, right? If you have to open a door, you just may stand outside and say, I don't really see anything, and just keep on walking past that store. But, you know, bars and businesses alike will prop open their doors, make themselves inviting, and then you come inside and, you know, you're a patron for that business. These mini valves work the same way. There are collagen fibers that tack them open. Okay, and so they will stand wide open, and it makes it really easy for any escaped, you know, plasma, any extra interstitial fluids to flow right into that lymphatic vessel. And so we're looking at a pressure gradient here. That's how fluids flow into your lymphatic vessel. They flow along a high pressure that's out here in your interstitial space to a low pressure that's inside. And it makes it really easy for those fluids to flow when the doors stand wide open. Well, what do you do when you have now collected a capillary full of fluids? Should you leave your doors open? Let your doors close, right? So these little collagen fibers that were tacking these doors open will relax. Those mini valves will now shut, just like the subway doors, they shut, everybody's inside now. And now the fluid is trapped inside your capillary, and it's flowing in one direction. It's going, of course, back toward the heart. So those mini valves are meant to help encourage the movement of fluid back into your capillary, and they're gonna shut when we have a high pressure inside that capillary. I think that's so cool. It's kind of like a subway that the doors stand open, you get on, the subway's now full, doors close, and then we're traveling. So that's the goal here, is to get the fluid back to the heart. Do you have questions so far about how the lymphatics work? All right, so let's look at the question down there at the bottom of your page. Number 4, at the very bottom of page 62, says, what do you think happens to lymph if there's a blockage in a lymphatic vessel? Yikes is the answer. Okay, so we know bad business happens when you get blockages in cardiovascular system. We know things like embolisms and thrombus and things like that can block the blood flow. We know that's bad business when that stuff breaks free. But when you think about these lymphatic vessels, if all of a sudden you create some kind of a blockage in here, and oh, there are some nasty things that can block them. There are little worms called Wuchereria, and I'll show you some pictures in a minute, of them blocking the larger lymphatics in the body. They just get in here and they hang out and they live. So if you block that flow path, what happens to all the fluid that should have been going back to your heart? Backs up, and it doesn't get back into the capillary. It hangs out where?
In the tissues.
So you end up having swelling in the tissue space, and we call that edema. And of course, those cells hanging out may also begin to swell. So, you know, yeah, it's bad business when you've got anything blocking a vessel, whether it's cardiovascular or lymphatic. All right, so to answer that question, what do you think happens to lymph? It cannot return to the heart. It stays in the interstitial space. Okay, so that fluid cannot return to the heart. It stays in the interstitial space. And if you're losing fluids that you can't get back, what happens to your cardiac output and blood pressure?
They drop.
So cardiac output and blood pressure will drop. Shows lymphatic vessels. They are colored green, so we don't get confused with red arteries or blue veins. And you can't really see from this picture, but they're all closed-end vessels, meaning that they're not circulating fluids, and of course their goal is to channel this fluid back toward the heart.
You will also notice in this picture there are collections of lymph nodes around the body. They're cleaning stations, and they're scattered every so often on these lymphatic vessels. There's a couple of main places. We'll talk about those in just a moment. So I wanted to show you the tangled mess here. This is a capillary bed with a set of lymphatics all woven throughout. So you can see they're sitting there right as a catch basin to help us get those escape fluids back into the circulation. I mean, I can't imagine if you didn't have these all over your entire body, what a battle this would be to get the fluids back. We would constantly be swollen without these lymphatic vessels picking up the escaped fluids. Here you can see the closed-in setup of these lymphatics, and they are very porous, permeable, allow those fluids to come back in. The flow pattern for lymph is actually over on page 63, and interestingly, it is not symmetric. So when we talk about blood flow, you know, we normally think of our bodies being divided into left and right, and we think of the blood flowing back to the heart in a fairly symmetric pattern. Totally not the case with your lymphatics. Lymphatics actually flow in a different pattern, completely different pattern. And I hope you can see that the right side of this guy is kind of shaded green. That includes the right side of his head, right arm, and right side of the chest cavity. That is a flow pattern that takes fluids back into a right duct, and that's called a lymphatic duct here. Those fluids ultimately are dumped into the right subclavian vein. We know the history from there. From the right subclavian vein, blood flows into the... Where's that? Right brachiocephalic, and then to the SVC. So ultimately, all these fluids on the right side go back into a duct, and the vein, of course, is where we receive that fluid back into the top part of the heart. You'll notice the rest of the body. That includes both legs, the left side of the chest cavity, the left arm, and the left side of the head actually flow into what they call a thoracic duct on the left side. Why they name them two different things, I don't know. It makes no sense to me. You'll notice they name the duct on the right side a right lymphatic duct. It takes lymph into the right subclavian vein. But catch this weirdness. On the left side, they simply call it a thoracic duct, and that takes fluids back into the left subclavian vein. That drives me nuts. You know, just name it the same thing on each side. But nonetheless, it is the subclavian veins where we are going to put these fluids back into circulation. We know from there the subclavians ultimately dump blood and lymph back into the right atrium of the heart. Okay, so interesting side note here. When somebody has a port put in, it is into this general area because these vessels are great at picking up all this excess flow of fluid. So if they have a chest port, that may be in fact where they hook it in. All right, let's talk about lymph nodes for just a moment. So I mentioned that lymph nodes are kind of like cleaning stations, and it is their job to help cleanse the lymph before it gets back to the heart. You know, you may be picking up bacteria or viruses. Even cancer cells can circulate by way of the lymphatic system. So this lymph must have an opportunity to be cleaned before it's dumped into full-on circulation. So you'll notice the lymph here is going to also produce lymphocytes. This is a very important role for the immune system. These lymphocytes help tag things like viruses and bacteria as foreign, and another cell may come along and eat and destroy those cells. So it's a really important process for us to clean and tag and remove these dangerous items from this circulating lymph. You do have lymph nodes scattered loosely in your connective tissues throughout your entire body, but you have a few places where you've got a high concentration of them. You have them around your neck. You may feel them as little kidney bean shaped. Some people call them glands. I wouldn't necessarily call them a gland like I would an endocrine gland, but nonetheless, they're kidney bean shaped all around the under the chin line. You have got them on the back of the neck. You've also got them in the armpit, and you've got them in the groin region here where the legs and the torso meet. So if you think about the flow pattern, where is all of this lymph going? Back to the heart, right. So lymph coming from the legs definitely passes through inguinal lymph nodes on the way back to the heart. What do the lymph in your arms pass through? Yeah, the axillaries in the armpit. And anything that's in your head is drained down through those cervicals. Yeah. So just to go back a moment and look at this big picture in green here. Way back. There are other places lymph nodes are found. They're scattered along the aorta, right here through the midline. There are other places in your body, so I don't want to imply they're just in those three locations. Okay. So here's some lymphocytes that are housed inside those lymph nodes. And I want to show you how lymph nodes are constructed, because they're set up in these chambers, which makes it great for cleaning and catching and destroying things that may be traveling through. First off, we've got to get the lymph into a lymph node, and these lymphatic vessels bring the lymph in. These vessels here, these efferent ones, take the lymph out. So I want you to notice that there's actually more afferent vessels bringing lymph to the lymph node than there are efferent vessels taking the lymph away from the lymph node. So why is that? You ever travel through a toll road? So if you travel through a toll road, you are probably looking at 6, 8, maybe 10 lanes where you can travel through. They'll collect your money. And then after you pass through that collection booth area, you narrow back down to maybe no more than 2 lanes. So they don't want to cause a clog in the flow pattern. They let plenty of cars come in, and then they let few cars exit by making those lanes narrow down very quickly. That's the concept here. If you've got a lot of vessels coming in, then you have a great opportunity to clean the lymph. But by only having a few leave, then you're letting the lymph kind of sit around in there, have an opportunity to be cleaned, and not exit too quickly. So it's a way to maintain the speed or the flow of the lymph through that lymph node. Now, once inside, you'll notice these little rooms or chambers. They are separated by strands of collagen fibers called trabecula. Okay, and that creates these little rooms where we can isolate things like viruses or bacteria or even cancer cells and hopefully destroy them. What happens if they escape your lymph node uncleaned? Yeah, you can get to the bloodstream, and then you've got a problem, right? You've now got a systemic issue where these cells, whether they're cancerous or bacterial, now can hit your entire body. Okay, so macrophages are in here, lymphocytes are in here. Macrophages are the big eaters. They actually eat and destroy things like bacteria. Lymphocytes are the ones that tag and identify cells or items like viruses as being foreign. So it's a way for us to maintain and manage how much, you know, collateral damage we've got traveling around our body. All right, so that should take you down there to the bottom of page 63. Before we completely leave behind the thought of these lymph nodes, I should mention that lymph nodes that are painful, you know, sometimes you'll have a painful lymph node, they're probably doing a job of cleaning something. Sometimes when you have a really awful head cold or sinus infection, you'll have painful cervical nodes around the neck. And that's just a sign that there's, you know, they're fighting, they're doing their job. We should, however, be concerned with lymph nodes when they're swollen but not painful. That may indicate something else that's going on, like cancers. So if you have swollen lymph nodes in the armpit, especially for women, this could be signs of breast cancer, something that should be checked. Likewise, when people have those lymph nodes removed, maybe through cancer surgery, especially with breast cancer surgery, that removes part of this cleansing process, and it also removes part of the ductwork that takes the fluids back to the heart. So that may lead to swelling in an arm if they happen to excise out some of those nodes and their surrounding ducts. All right, so I wanted to mention some lymphoid organs. These organs play a role in the lymphatic system, but they may also have other jobs. So they're found on page 64. All right, so the spleen is our first lymphoid organ. It's found on the left side of your abdominopelvic cavity. It is an encapsulated organ. And what I mean by that is it's wrapped in a type of membrane. The reason that's important is because if the spleen ruptures and the capsule around it ruptures, then we have to remove that spleen. It doesn't really take kindly to healing its capsule once it's been ruptured. If you have an injury, that can rupture the spleen. If you have an infection and you happen to be hit in that area, that creates a more likely instance where the spleen can be broken open.
So is that why when you get mono, they tell you not to engage in any crazy activity?
Yeah.
Because if it hits the spleen, it's going to rupture?
It's gonna pop open, yeah.
Is it swollen or?
It probably is, and we just don't realize it, but the job that it's doing is why it's probably swollen in the first place. So this is actually one of those organs that you can live without because there's kind of an organ that plays a backup role to it. If you lose your spleen, what organ picks up the job? The liver, yeah. So inside the spleen, if you were to think of a sponge, that'd be a great way to visualize how the spleen works. The spleen is a great filtering organ. When red blood cells travel through here, if they're ragged, then the spongy tissue of the spleen will trap and remove those red blood cells. So we kind of think of the spleen, because it's helping to remove some of these damaged blood cells from circulation, as a blood reservoir. That way, if you happen to need an emergency source of red blood cells, they're actually trapped here and housed in the spleen. Okay, so you'll notice that storing blood is one job, cleaning out old and defective red blood cells is another job, and then storing platelets too. So in cases where you need a quick source of those blood cells, we do have them either circulating through or being removed from circulation in the spleen. So I underlined for you the important points to keep in mind: cleansing blood, storing red blood cells, and storing platelets. The next important one here is thymus gland. We've actually talked about this one briefly before. This one is also an endocrine gland, and it's found in the chest cavity over your heart, underlying your sternum. But unlike other glands in your body, this one actually dries up and atrophies by the time you reach your late teenage years. It's done its job by that point. So which hormone is made by your thymus gland? Thymosin, good. And what is the type of white blood cell that it programs?
T cells,
right, and your type of lymphocyte. And you say, well, hey, if I'm programming my immune system as a kid growing up, and this gland atrophies in my late teenage years, what happens when I'm 40, 70, 100 years old and I encounter something that's like a virus or a bacterium? I no longer have this gland. Well, there's actually other places in your body where you can still program those T cells, and it's another T location, it's your tonsils. So another good reason to keep our tonsils around. All right, so that should take care of thymus. Let's talk about tonsils for just a moment. And this picture shows a set of them around the mouth and nose areas. Of course, you've got 5 tonsils, not 6 like this picture shows. I think this is funny because this was actually in a textbook for a number of years, and I use it as a talking point because there's not 6 tonsils, there's actually a total of 5. And they're clusters of cells that are sitting around your oral and your nasal cavity openings. All right, so in the back of your mouth, when you say ah, on either side there's an oval-shaped patch of tonsils, and those are called what? Palatine tonsils. Okay, if you were to stick out your tongue really, really far, you might see a set of them sitting at the base of the tongue, and those are lingual tonsils. None of us can see our own adenoids or pharyngeal tonsils. We would have to use a lighted scope and look up through the nose, and that actually shows us those adenoids, which is one giant cluster of cells sitting at the back of our throat. So they're sitting somewhat above the soft palate. We can't see them on ourselves, but we can see them on somebody else. So you can see they're sitting around the openings to your mouth and your nose. What are they trapping? microbes, right? Anything you breathe in through your mouth or your nose is going to be filtered past one of these tonsils, gives us the opportunity to remove microbes, bacteria, viruses before they make their way further on. So what systems are we protecting with our tonsils? Yeah, respiratory primarily, and then to some extent the digestive system. So it's a great way to keep those foreign invaders from making it further into our bodies. All right, and then finally, we have something similar in our intestines. Down here, you'll notice they're scattered around the small intestine, and they're called Peyer's or Peyer's patches, however you'd like to say it. So they're protecting our digestive system from microbes. You know, even though we have a very different lifestyle nowadays than, say, 200 years ago, we're afforded the opportunity to have food that's free from bacterial infections and invasions. We are not eating things that could potentially make us sick every single day. But we still have food poisoning. We still get things that give us an upset stomach or diarrhea or other things that impact our digestive pathways. So for that reason, we have these Peyer's or Peyer's patches that are like tonsils, but they're loosely embedded in our mucosa tissue. And that would be the innermost lining of your digestive tract. So it is their job to kind of do the same thing that tonsils do, trap bacteria and pathogens before they make their way into our bloodstream. Unfortunately, if you absorb bacteria into your bloodstream, where does it go? Back to the heart. And then it goes all over the body, right? So that's not what we want to have happen. So this is yet another way to stop that spread before it gets into the systemic blood flow. You'll notice the very bottom line down there, it's called MALT, mucosa-associated lymphatic tissue. Tonsils and Peyer's patches are embedded in the mucosa linings of your digestive tracts, and it is their job to help protect us from pathogens like bacteria and viruses. So tonsils and these Peyer's patches are part of this MALT system. I didn't mention the appendix as part of our lymphoid organs, but we do believe that it plays a role in the lymphatic system by also collecting bacteria. We'll talk more about it in the later chapters when we talk about digestive. It hangs as a blind, closed-in pouch off the right side of your cecum. That's that part of your digestive system. Okay, so I know you've got a lot to look at, so I did underline the important terms to remember here on this page. Hopefully that'll reduce how much you've got to study on that page. And you know what? That is actually it, because 65 and 66 are going to be review pages. But for fun, I just wanted to show you some pathologies associated with this system. I know you've heard of the bubonic plague or the Black Death. This is something that's been around for centuries. And if you watch the news, every now and again, there'll be something that pops across a news feed about somebody's got the bubonic plague, and you think, oh my gosh, have we gone back to the Middle Ages? It actually never went away. So there are some cases that pop up every now and again, and this particular disorder, disease, is transmitted by fleas, and fleas are, of course, carried by everything from rats to cats and dogs. So the infection actually gets into your lymphatic system, and it causes these swollen nodes that we call buboes. So that's what you're looking at here, and they can develop all over the body if this infection goes systemic. Very painful. Unfortunately, people did die from this, as you know, back in the middle times. This is another problem that can arise from lymphatic blockages. This is called lymphedema. And in this situation, a person may have had plasma proteins escape the cardiovascular system and unfortunately not be able to get back into either cardiovascular or lymphatic pathways. So do proteins create hydrostatic or osmotic pressure?
Osmotic.
So are they pulling fluids or are they pushing them?
Pulling.
They're attracting fluids. So if plasma proteins sit in your interstitial space, then they act like a magnet for fluid. Fluid that gets stuck out there in the interstitial space says, oh, I love you, protein, I ain't ever leaving you. They hang out with that protein, and you don't get those fluids back. Bad news here, look at these legs. They can be swollen from lymphedema, about the only thing you can do is wear compression hose to help maintain fluid return back to the heart. But unfortunately, there's not a lot we can do. We can't really give a medicine. We can't do much to get the proteins back into the blood flow because they're big. So those proteins are too large to move back into your cardiovascular pathway. And for whatever reason, we can't get them back into our lymphatic pathway. So they are stuck in that interstitial space. Sometimes when people have surgery, if we simply take out lymphatic pathways, then there's no way for escape fluids to get back to the heart, as is the case here for a post-mastectomy patient. You'll notice a swelling in her arm. That must be the side she had the surgery on and those lymph nodes removed. And this is a nasty little disease. It's called Wuchereria, and it causes a condition called elephantiasis. And, you know, with climate change, it worries me that here we go. Look at this area of the world that has this little worm. If climate changes, then we could be seeing it move further away from the equator belt of the world. So this particular little worm has a life cycle that's involved with mosquitoes, nasty mosquitoes. They're the bane of our existence, right? So they get into a life cycle with mosquitoes. Mosquitoes bite us, and the larvae of this worm are then put into our bloodstream. This, unfortunately, is something that now reproduces in our bloodstream. It escapes into our interstitial space. Ah, and there's how it gets into the lymphatic system, is by escaping the cardiovascular. It causes blockages wherever those worms set up residence. So you can see both legs here. That is all fluid that's been blocked. Over here, you've got one leg that's blocked, other leg completely normal. And unfortunately, again, unless you can kill the worms, you're just going to have to deal with having that blockage in that area. And the blockage could be anywhere.
Oh.
Yeah. So nowadays we have antibiotics. The antibiotics should be given to kill those worms. That's got to be painful. So let's look at something.
There's no way like they can get... Like,
no, like, just like a
bowling ball. I mean, I know they're in third world country or whatever, but couldn't they get like neutered? So they wouldn't have all that weight on them all the time?
That may be the answer, because if they kill the worms, that is still swollen with all that fluid and all that excess skin, so that may be something that would require surgery. Yep. Yep. Mosquitoes.
They need to die.
Yes, they do. All right. So that takes us through to the end of this chapter. And I'd like to turn the floor over to you now for questions for the test on Tuesday. You've got to keep straight what causes pressures to go up, pressures to go down, heart rates to go up, and heart rates to go down. So like if I say epinephrine's released from the sympathetic nervous system, your thoughts are the heart rate's going to go up, right? And vessels, what will happen to them? They will. And then now blood pressure goes up. So you want to think about... Yeah, you think about how it impacts. Some things directly impact blood pressure. Some things directly impact heart rate. For instance, ADH. Let's talk about that one for a moment. What does ADH tell your kidneys to do?
Retain
water. And the more water you have, the more cardiac output you have. Cardiac output directly causes your blood pressure to go up. And if your blood pressure goes up, then secondarily, your heart may then say, well, to circulate all this fluid, I now have to speed it up. So there are direct influences and indirect influences, but all this stuff kind of works in tandem, hand in hand. Let's do another one. Let's say that you had a fright, you're scared, and you're trying to calm yourself back down by breathing slowly. You're trying to put what system back in control of your heart rate? Good. And which nerve? And which neurotransmitter?
Acetylcholine.
And it tells your SA node to do what to its rate? Slow down. Now, can you tell your vessels using parasympathetic to relax?
No.
You just have to stop sending messages to the which system?
Sympathetic.
So you got to kill that sympathetic response and ramp up that parasympathetic response. So it's understanding cause and effect. Like if I'm scared, I'm going to be having a racing heart, but I can calm myself through parasympathetic activity. So it's getting all those gears straight there. Want to do a couple more?
Yeah.
Okay, let's see. Drinking alcohol cuts off which hormone?
ADH.
So if we shut off ADH, we stop retaining water, and where does your blood pressure go?
Down.
Okay, so let's go back through that. If you drink alcohol, you shut off ADH, your kidneys say, hey, no retaining water here, all the water flushes through, you pee like crazy, and your blood pressure goes down. And that's because your cardiac output went down. So baroreceptors in your heart say, pressure's really low. They have no idea that you've been drinking alcohol, right? So the baroreceptor sends a message to your medulla, and your medulla now says, turn on sympathetic. And so sympathetic responses come back to your SA node, and now what happens to help you out? Speed up the heart, right? And then the vessels also squeeze, and you start getting increased blood pressure. But that may be hours after you've had an alcoholic drink, right? That's not going to be within 10 minutes necessarily. So the point I'm trying to make here is you've got to think about what something does in terms of cause and effect, and then how your body will fix those problems.
Is that why you feel warm when you drink afterwards?
It's partly the vessels dilate to some extent with the alcohol, and then maybe later on, yeah, you may have more blood flow because of the increased heart rate, but initially it's probably the dilation of the vessels. Yeah. Let's talk about another thing. Let's talk about smoking cigarettes with nicotine. And what does nicotine do to blood vessel diameter? Constricts it. So now blood pressure goes up. Well, the baroreceptors don't know what you're doing. So the baroreceptors say, hey, you know, pressure's really high here. So what message do they send, or what actually decision does your medulla make about that? Parasympathetic, yeah. So your parasympathetic is trying to reduce your heart rate, which is going against that nicotine, which is raising pressure and inadvertently heart rate as well. So that's one effect that we could talk about. Let's do another one. Let's do histamine. What does histamine cause your vessels to do? Dilate, right. Pressure goes low, right. Let's talk about, I had a thought and it left me. I have to look, hold on. What's that?
Nitrous oxide.
Let's do nitrous, yeah. What does nitrous do to vessels? Go to the dentist's office, get nitrous, it's laughing gas, you are relaxed. Yeah, it relaxes you, it relaxes your vessels, and it does what to your blood pressure?
Lowers
it. And if you've ever had this done, they'll put a little pulse oximeter on your finger, because if you're too relaxed, what happens to your oxygen levels?
Goes
down. So that's their way of knowing if they've given you too much nitrous. Let's talk oxygen levels. Let's say that someone travels into the mountains, really, really high mountains with low levels of oxygen. What kind of receptor in the aortic arch now detects this problem?
Chemoreceptor.
Because this person has low oxygen levels, the medulla turns on which system?
Sympathetic,
right. Because it's going to tell your heart rate to
speed up
and your vessels to constrict, and your blood pressure will also go up, right. So if you're experiencing low oxygen levels, you're going to have a faster heart rate and higher blood pressure as a result. Let's talk about exercise. Exercise gives you excess CO2. And now again, what type of receptor picks up on this problem?
Chemoreceptor,
good. And the medulla now says, oh, hypercapnia is what the problem's called. Too much CO2, what do we do with our heart rate and blood pressure? Do you want to get rid of it faster, or do you want to keep it more?
Get rid of it.
Get rid of it. So how do you make everything move faster? Sympathetic, right? Okay, so if you have too much CO2, think about climbing the stairs in this building. By the time you're at the top, you're breathing fast, your heart rate's up, your blood pressure's up, right? And so all of that is working in tandem to help you blow off that CO2 as fast as you can. As soon as you get rid of the excess CO2, what happens to all three problems? You go back to normal, right? Your breathing, your heart rate, your blood pressure all fall back to normal. So is that sympathetic or parasympathetic at work? That's sympathetic. So what happens to your SA nodes rate? Speeds up. And what happens to your vessel diameter?
Constricts.
Good. Okay. How do you feel with that topic? Getting there? Okay. What else would you like to review? Diastole, systole, sitting okay? Cardiac cycle. Okay. With pressures, valves, all that good business. Okay, let's do a picture on that. No, not that one either. Actually, I have a side thought for you. I sent you guys a link to American Heart Association. Did you happen to look at any of those animations? If you haven't and you need help kind of visualizing how stuff works, they have a really fantastic set of animations on American Heart Association's website. It's heart.org, and it's really great, nice, clean, clear animations that you can look at. Okay, so going back to this. Okay, so when we're talking about mid to late ventricular diastole, we are talking about mid to late heart at rest. Diastole means rest, and because we're saying ventricular diastole, we mean the ventricles are resting. During this time period, blood is flowing into the heart under what type of pressure? Low pressure, good. And we receive blood from three veins coming into the right atrium. Those three veins are? Good. SVC, IVC, and coronary sinus. Is that blood oxygenated or deoxygenated? Deoxygenated. Blood flows at the very same time into your left atrium. It comes from the pulmonary veins. And these two AV valves are currently open, so the blood continues on and drains down into those two ventricles. Now, about this time, the SA node fires off an impulse. A P wave shows up on your EKG, meaning what? Atria are depolarizing. They're getting ready to contract, right? So when they contract, they squeeze. Blood flows down through these open AV valves, and it collects down here in each ventricle. Right now, because we have reached the end of diastole, we are looking at a volume of blood in each ventricle called what? End diastolic or end systolic? End diastolic, good. And that's about how much blood in each ventricle?
120,
good. So 120 milliliters in each ventricle. We are now at the end of the rest period. And about this time, we're going to switch over to the other picture. We enter what's called ventricular systole. So now the AV node gets the message. It sends an impulse down the bundle of His. It splits into bundle branches and travels the walls of your ventricles, terminating in Purkinje fibers. We now see a QRS wave show up on your EKG. That represents what is happening. You got it. Ventricular depolarization. Good.
and the ventricles are getting ready to contract. So as they contract and the papillary muscles inside of them contract, we are now going to slam shut which valves?
The
AV valves. Yep. So they create a sound that's like
love.
Right. So the strings, those chordae tendineae, pull them shut. We hear a love noise and pause right now. We have an isobiometric phase. Which one?
Contraction.
Because we're getting ready to contract, right? So right now, we're increasing pressure, the ventricles are squeezing, and we have to have an exit route, basically. So blood is forced up through the pulmonary and the semilunar, aortic semilunar valves. They are forced open, and now we're going to inject about how much blood from each ventricle?
70
milliliters, good. And that volume that we're injecting is known as?
Stroke
volume, good. And the percentage of blood that we're injecting is known as? Ejection fraction, yeah. All right, so what we're left with is blood in each ventricle. It's our end systolic volume. And how much is it?
50.
About 50 milliliters, right? And so when we're thinking about pressures here, when the right ventricle contracts, the pressure is a really low number. It's about what? 24, 25, yeah, really low. And the left ventricle's pressure is much higher.
120.
Yeah, 110, 120 is a great number there. So we know left side pressure must be higher because where is it sending blood?
To
the whole body, right, out of the systemic circuit. So blood that is ejected from the left ventricle travels to the aorta. That aorta ultimately takes blood to the heart. So we're looking at out to the body, not to the heart, right? So we're looking at a systemic pathway there. I do want to mention that there's a couple of vessels that sneak away some blood from the aorta that serve the heart itself. Those are called coronary arteries. And what circulation are they nourishing on the heart itself? Cardiac or coronary circulation, yes. Yeah, so if you actually bar some of that blood away, we'll get some for the heart wall itself. Okay, so now we've reached the end of ventricular diastole, and we're back to where we started. We're back to a mid to late, finished systole, rather ending now with diastole. So the whole cycle, this process is called a cardiac cycle. Takes about how many seconds? 0.8 seconds, right. And for a routine heartbeat and rest of how many beats per minute?
75,
good. And on average, we're circulating how many liters of blood around the body?
5 liters,
good. And that volume that we're circulating is known as cardiac
output,
good. And of course, cardiac output is dependent upon two factors. They are stroke volume and heart rate, good. Stroke volume and heart rate. And they're all dependent upon one another. If one goes up, they're all going to go up. Flipping it the other way, blood pressure depends on two factors. One is cardiac output. The other is peripheral resistance. Good. And the one type of peripheral resistance we can control with our medulla is?
Stress.
Not vessel length, but vessel
diameter.
That's the only thing we can control using our medulla. Okay. What's your next topic?
Can you repeat the two things that factor into what you just said about stroke volume and cardiac output? What is that like?
Cardiac output is the heart chapter, and that's dependent upon two things. It's heart rate and stroke volume. Okay. In fact, we can do the math, and we know that we're looking at about 5 liters of blood being circulated every minute because it's based on roughly 75 beats per minute and about 70 milliliters per stroke volume.
We also have blood pressure, which is dependent upon cardiac output and peripheral resistance. And really, the main influence here over blood pressure is cardiac output. It's ultimately how much fluid you're circulating that you have to account for. So that directly influences blood pressure. That's our number one determinant of blood pressure. And then there were actually three types of peripheral resistance: viscosity, vessel length, and vessel diameter. But of those three, we really only can control the vessel diameter. Now we're running out of time. Is there anything else I can help you with?
Can you just give like an example of what type of question you ask? Is it like a cause and effect if something happens to?
I may say to you, we have a stenotic narrowed vessel, you know, one that's kind of tiny and you can't get the blood out. How does that impact cardiac output, or how does that impact stroke volume, or how does that impact, you know, ejection fraction? Down, actually, because if you squeeze and tighten the opening, you can't get as much blood to pump out. Old tests have some really good examples just like that one. If y'all have any questions over the weekend, feel free to email me.